Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the Straight Talking Savings Bank.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You're welcome to Tuesday's Game On. Golf, soccer, Gaelic games and a bit of nostalgia to come between now and 8 o'clock. Nicky O'Connell is back within the Clare hurling frame. The latest from the banner to come, a fresh development in that ongoing story late last night. We'll chat about that in a moment. Big night of Champions League football ahead. The quarterfinals getting underway. We will discuss the Madrid derby and the rest of the games of the week shortly. Gary Murphy just back from Augusta National. Colin Byrne caddied all week for Ernie Els. Two good men to get reflections on the Masters from. Pat Spillane, a guest last night on the programme. We were chatting about the Allianz Football League semi-finals. A lot of you making contact with us on text and Twitter. Not happy with the quality of football. GAA can't really do an awful lot about that, but questions to be asked possibly about the attendance and the atmosphere. And tonight we will give the game's governing body, the GAA, the right to respond. 51552 for your text. You can tweet the programme at GameOn2FM. We'll get us between now and 8 o'clock. Good to have you on board. It's Gaelic Games to begin, where news emerged from Clare late last night that Nicky O'Connell had returned to the county hurling fold. He was one of those three players disciplined after a falling out with manager Davy Fitzgerald last month. One of those stories that seems to have dragged on and on much more than perhaps it should have done, but somewhat of a resolution in sight. Let's chat about that and more with Seamus Hayes, sports editor of the Clare Champion. Seamus, how are you?
Not too bad, Damien. How are you?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you. First and foremost, is this a surprise or was it always inevitable that peace would break out?
I suppose in a way it was always inevitable, or it was always hoped for anyhow by the supporters of Clare Hurling, like Nicky O'Connell and Davy O'Holland for that matter, are two very talented hurlers. And you know, Clare, while they have a lot of good hurlers at the moment, as we've seen over the last couple of years, we still cannot afford to be without any player of that type of quality. So I think there's general rejoicing around the county today that Nicky O'Connell is back within the fold and is back training, I understand, tonight.
Talk us through, as you know it, exactly what happened or how this came to be.
As I understand it, Nicky made contact with the management sometime over the weekend, expressing a desire to return. He met with them last night. I know he played a club game for his club last night for Clonlara, and seemingly after that he went and met the management because they had a recovery session last night for the vast majority of the players on the panel who were playing games at the weekend with their clubs and a challenge game with Clare. He met with them. I understand he apologised for his actions that led to the problem in the first place, and asked if he could rejoin the panel, and I'm told that they were more than delighted to accept him back in.
So perhaps, you know, in many ways, if you hear of a guy apologising to a panel, that maybe inherent in that is an acknowledgement of wrongdoing, that it's, you know, a case of let's put this behind us and let's move on, and we'll all be forgotten about by the time the Munster Championship rolls around.
Well, I'd say, hopefully, certainly from a supporter's point of view, it would. Like, Nicky O'Connell is a very, very talented player. He played at some stage in every game in 2013 when Clare won the championship, and it was he who provided the pass to his clubmate Donal O'Donovan for the equalising point in the drawn game on that occasion in the final minute of that game. And you know, he played a big part in that success, and he is a very, very talented hurler. And now that it has transpired in recent weeks that Colm Galvin is gone travelling for the summer, you know, there is a vacancy, if you like, in a crucial midfield area, and Nicky has plenty of experience of playing in that position, both with club and county in the past, so he's probably likely to be one of the guys who will be challenging to come in while Colm Galvin is away.
Just, you look at it, the year hasn't, well, you know, the last 12 months hasn't gone how Clare or anyone in Clare would have liked it to have gone in terms of on-field results. And to what extent do you think that feed into an increased scrutiny of this incident? Perhaps was it disproportionate to what might have happened had things been going well?
Yeah, I think that where a lot of the problem came from is I think that a lot of people didn't realise maybe how strict the management and the setup, the regulations are within the setup. You know, the regulations were drawn up and seemingly signed up to by all the players. Now, I suppose it's like everything else, it's easy to be wise in hindsight. Maybe looking back on it now, people might have looked at it a little differently and maybe not have been as strong in some of the punishments, if you like. Should there be breaches of discipline, it's only when these things happen, I suppose, that the focus comes on what happened. But you know, the results in the past year, from a senior point of view, I suppose, were disappointing. But you know, Clare still won the third in a row All-Ireland Under-21 title, so there's no shortage of talent there. And you know, they had two great games at Wexford last year, and Wexford were coming strong at the time. I think Clare showed in the relegation playoff a couple of weeks ago against Kilkenny that they still have an awful lot to offer, and that they are still one of the leading lights in the hurling world, and will on that type of form challenge strongly for honours this year. So I suppose from that point of view, everybody will be hoping, that everything will settle down now. What has been noticeable, I suppose, all along is that there hasn't been any comment from any players, in relation to this incident, other than, whatever was said after the disciplinary action. But none of the other players have got involved publicly. They issued a statement, supporting management and saying that they wanted to just focus on their preparations for the upcoming season and for what looks like being a very, very tough championship campaign ahead.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking, I'm looking at it here, the 24th of May, Clare against Limerick in Semple Stadium, isn't it? That, it's not the easy, well, I suppose in Munster there's not going to be any easy start, but it's a fairly formidable game, and you can imagine with what's gone on and with form that pressure is going to be fairly intense the week of that game.
It certainly will, and it has always been said that irrespective of form, when Clare and Limerick meet in the Championship, form goes out the window and there won't be a puck of a ball in that game. One or other of those teams could at any given time be, we'll say, miles ahead on the picking order, if you like, from the other. But when they meet, there's nothing in it. And, there's such a rivalry there that they will, both sides will get up to the top of the ladder for that particular game. But it's a massive, massive game. If Clare were to have success this year by going the direct route, they would have to beat Limerick. They then would have to beat Tipperary. They then would have to beat Cork or Waterford, and that would only get them out of Munster. And you still have the likes of Galway and Kilkenny or Dublin or Wexford, further down the line. So the draw has been, it's one of the hardest draws, I suppose, in the game this year from a Clare point of view if they're going to make progress. So they have to be ready and they have to get their house in order very fast and get back to the best form, which they showed signs of against Kilkenny there 2 weeks ago.
And the margin between success and failure, or good form and bad form, is fairly slim. So they might not be too far off it. Just to finish, we now have two of the three players firmly back in the fold. Is there hope for Davy O'Halloran?
Well, I think the public would hope that there is. Certainly he's a hugely talented player. We saw that he's won. Over the last 3 or 4 years with the Clare Minors and the Clare Under-21s, he has won a number of Man of the Match awards in provincial and All-Ireland championship games. And he has an awful lot to offer. And it's noticeable that he hasn't hurled for club or county since this particular incident, but he has played football for his club. He's also a very talented footballer. And his club is a very strong dual club. His club is Aero here in Innes. But, I'd say the feeling around the county today is that the supporters would be hoping that this might open the door for Davy maybe to travel maybe the same route as Nicky and follow him back into the panel. Whether that will happen now or not is another day's work.
But presumably he would have to make the approach. It would have to be player driven.
I would say that's the way it looks, because Nicky, as I understand it, made the approach, and he approached management about going back. And the third player involved in that particular incident was Nicky's brother Carl, who didn't leave the panel, but who stayed on and took his punishment or whatever, and has been very much part of the sit-up in the last couple of weeks, and actually played against Kilkenny in that game.
We live in interesting times. Good to talk to you, Seamus. Thanks for joining us.
No problem, Damien. Thank you.
Seamus Hayes, the Clare champion there. 51552 for your text, or you can tweet at GameOn2FM if you're a Clare fan, has got a perspective on that. We're going to stay with Gaelic games. We spoke last night to Pat Spillane about the Allianz Football League semi-finals, and he wasn't blown away by the wins for Cork or Dublin. That's his personal opinion. But the view that came in on text and on tweets from a lot of you, that you had things to say about the atmosphere and the attendance and everything else. So only right that we would give the GAA the right to respond and chat about those issues and more. And delighted to say Alan Milton, who's head of media relations with the Gaelic Athletic Association, joins us. Alan, how are you?
How are you doing, Damien?
Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking the call.
Likewise.
Let's first and foremost, you can't do anything to control the quality of the football that's on display. So we'll lay the blame for if people weren't happy with the tactics, with the managers and players. But overall, attendance, atmosphere, how things played out on Sunday, how satisfied would GAA HQ be?
Well, I think it's probably very important as a starting point to make a clear distinction between what takes place when players cross the white line, namely the game on the field of play, and what happens in the stands. Now, obviously they're related because one feeds off the other, but you're right, we're perilous to powerless to dictate what takes place when two teams take to the field, and it's a very special dynamic. Anytime 30 players or 35 players over the course of a game go head to head. For what it's worth, my personal opinion, I thought the two games were enjoyable and entertaining games on Sunday, and I sat back for a detached position and watched them. I thought they were really high scoring. I thought there was great exhibitions of long range shooting. Admittedly, some of the teams set themselves up very defensively, which is their prerogative to do so, but I don't believe it had a negative impact on the games that we were treated to. In relation to the attendance, I think we had what you might describe as a perfect storm, in that, unfortunately, we had a rematch of a game that was very one-sided only 7 days earlier in Clonus, which we were powerless to do anything about. With torrential rain in Dublin on Sunday morning for anyone that was in the capital, and there were other sporting events on. So, all told, the attendance wasn't as high as we would have liked it to have been, but I think those people who came saw two decent games.
Mm. And I know, obviously, you know, every sport, effectively, you're in the entertainment industry as much as you are in terms of, you know, generating sporting events. And a lot has been done by all the governing bodies across the country to try and make events more attractive. But it must be a challenge from an organisational point of view to try and attract people to come from particularly Cork and Donegal all the way to Dublin for a game on a Sunday.
Absolutely. I suppose, I don't dispute the fact that, for example, over the years I would have dealt with Graham County a fair bit, and I often spoke to him on the international rules tours about his journey from Bantry to Dublin reaches halfway somewhere in County Cork. So I never take it for granted that I can stroll in from West Dublin into Croke Park and be in there in 30 minutes or 40 minutes. I have the option of using public transport, which brings me to the door. Same if I'm coming from Greedore and you've young children. So, you know, I don't overestimate that. I think the option here is, would you have put Cork and Donegal in Tullamore or in Galway? And I think if you had done that, I think you would have been looking at a crowd of less than 5,000 people. So you talk to the players as well. This is another hugely important factor. We surveyed the players on a quite regular basis, and the feedback we get all the time from speaking with them would be that they want to play in Croke Park. It's the place that they want to play the big games. And as we found out last year when an All-Ireland Hurling football semi-final replay was taken out of Croke Park, there was a huge debate about it at the time. So I think most people would accept Croke Park is a very large stadium. It holds 82,300 people. It's probably only full a couple of times, two or three times a year. But that said, I think it was a unique set of circumstances that led to an attendance of just over 20,000 last Sunday. And I wouldn't be expecting a repeat of that attendance either for the remainder of this year, for games of that magnitude, or in future years when Allianz football or hurling semi-finals are taking place.
Not to play devil's advocate then, but if the players want to play in Croke Park, why are we going to Nolan Park this Sunday?
Well, I think there's a reason why we're going to Nolan Park this Sunday, is because the geographic reason for the four counties makes perfect sense. We've had a tremendous success taking games to Semple Stadium and most notably Nolan Park. I think anybody who was in Nolan Park for the qualifier game of Kilkenny and Tipperary will talk about it for many years to come. We've had an Allianz Hurling League final there too. I don't think we're dealing with like with like, in that the northern half of the county is not represented as strongly in the football stakes as the hurling counties are. So I think it's a very logical fit, and I think anybody who makes the journey to Nolan Park this weekend and pays €15 for a double header ticket in Kilkenny will get unrivaled value, and I don't believe there's value to be out to be got out there anywhere for Dublin, Cork, Waterford, Tipperary. I think they're two intriguing games this weekend.
Overall, the reintroduction of the semi-finals, the way you're speaking, it's something that you think has gone well, or something that you think has the potential to be there for time to come.
Well, every year they review the CCC, the Central Control Competitions Committee, which is a subsidiary or which reports into Ard Cualia, the Central Council of the GA, will make a report in a given year. But I think you'd agree with me when I say, Damien, or maybe you won't, but I think the last weekend of the group stages of the leagues are absolutely fascinating. Like, we had an intriguing Sunday, the Sunday before last. I didn't have enough devices to keep up with what was going on in the different games around the place.
Calculator Sunday.
Yeah, exactly. And you simply don't have that level of intrigue if you don't have semi-finals, because there has to be, there's more counties. I counted 21 counties out of 35 on the start of that Sunday who had something to play for that day. I think it's hugely absorbing. The second thing is, we don't have very many massive or very many high-profile occasions at national level in Croke Park between the months of, well, from obviously St. Patrick's Day, we've got the club finals, but around this time of the year during the league. So from a profiling perspective of our games, I think it makes sense. But it's not set in stone, and it's reviewed on an annual basis. And if there was a strong groundswell of support amongst our counties to review the situation, that's precisely what would happen via the vehicle that is our Qualia.
Because I'm just thinking, you talk about the excitement for the end of the league campaign, and I forgive me for comparing sport with sport, but like, you think, for example, we're heading into the closing weekends now with the Pro 12 rugby, and the clamour straight away is for home advantage for the semi-finals. Who'll finish first and second? Logistically, is that something that the GAA could look to do, that, you know, Cork finished on top of Division 1 and in by doing so perhaps could play one of the semi-finals in Cork to have the home advantage that you've earned by finishing top of the table?
Well, in theory, yes, it is. But like, I read the comments this morning from the Cork chairman, Ger Lane, who said that like, the year after they won the All-Ireland in football, I think he quoted they had 2,000 or 3,000 people in Parky Rin for a league game. So there's a strong tradition in Gaelic games of use of the neutral venue, especially when you've got four counties like that. And as I said, I wouldn't read too much into last weekend. Was it a disappointing attendance? Yes, it was. And we review it internally, and we're already busy engaging with our media partners and more to try and market the semi-finals this weekend and the finals that will follow. But I don't believe that you're looking into a doomsday scenario by any stretch of the imagination. I think we've had exciting semi-finals in recent years. And as I said to you already, I think the games, I think the players deserve credit, and the counties indeed, for the games that they served up last week. I don't share the view that, and everyone, it's very subjective. Everyone sees a different game of football or hurling when they go to it. But I would find it hard to pick holes in the games themselves last weekend. And if people go there for the atmosphere, generally speaking, the atmosphere and what happens in the stands is an add-on or is a bonus. But obviously, when you don't have a large attendance there, that is impacted upon, and I think you've got to accept that hands down.
One of the things, just to finish, one of the elements that came up in conversation last night was the proximity to the Ulster Championship. And, you know, Donegal have the minor matter of Tyrone 3 weeks after the league final, and you've got Monaghan have an equally big game against Cavan. And that it is understandable if teams have one eye on the Championship, because that will be what will define their year. But again, there's probably very little you can do about that, unless you shift the league much earlier in the year, that all teams have a certain window of time to prepare then for the provincial championships.
Well, we're down to trying to square the circle again, aren't we? Well, you've got a province with nine counties in Ulster, you've got five in Connacht, you've 12 in Leinster, without giving anybody a geography lesson. So there's a very obvious difficulty there, that the more counties you have in the province, it goes with the territory that you're going to have to start your competition earlier. This is being debated, and I think it'll be debated again as the counties come back with their feedback in relation to the playing of our competitions in the calendar year. I think all of our competitions will be reviewed, and if it's deemed appropriate to try and condense the calendar, and whether that leads to a review of the early season competitions on the provincial stages, be that as it may. But I definitely think it's worth considering. But you're never going to have a situation where every county's going to have the exact same run-in between the league and the championship. It's just really, really difficult to arrange, but given the numbers of counties involved in the provincial championships.
One text, we'll finish on this, and I think the minute you said it, I was thinking this would come in on text. Eamon in Cork, will you please point out that Croke Park isn't a neutral venue for Dublin? But the counter-argument is that Croke Park would be seen as the national stadium or the association stadium rather than Dublin's home stadium.
Yeah, well, Dublin County Committee are fortunate in that the capital of the country happens to be in Dublin. Secondly, the Leinster counties, 11 of them voted this year to keep Dublin in Croke Park, so not everybody's as vexed about that, but I don't think anybody can put up a cogent argument that there's not a distinct advantage for Dublin teams playing in Croke Park, and that's just something because they happen to play their games in the capital city where they're from.
Okay, Alan, appreciate you taking the call.
Anytime,
thanks for your time.
And all the best.
Alan Milton, Head of Media Relations with the GAA, joining us there. 51552 for your texts at GameOn2FM on Twitter.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
And it's soccer next. The first night of this season's Champions League, UEFA Champions League quarterfinal, sees a repeat of last year's final. Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid will meet at the Vicente Calderon. Real haven't beaten Atletico in their previous six meetings this season. Atletico have won both league meetings. They've won in the Spanish Super Cup and they've won in the Copa del Rey. So let's get some insight on that from Spanish journalist Begoña Pérez. Real are being almost universally tipped, from what I've been reading today and various sources, to advance beyond the two legs. But that flies completely in the face of those facts and the encounters between the sides so far this season.
I think, well, we can expect this. This is going to be a very tight tie. I mean, don't forget Real Madrid haven't been able to beat Atletico in the last six games of the season, basically since they won the Champions League final in Lisbon, which was also a tight game. Atletico were very close to win it until Sergio Ramos scored the equalizer in injury time. And this is only the first leg. These are 180 minutes match, basically, so we can expect Atletico being aggressive on defensive duty, being very strong to avoid any away goal from Real Madrid, but also trying to score a goal as soon as possible. Possibly that could be a tactic from Simeone to hold things from the very first minute. Mm. And Real will try to take the initiative. They need it. They have this urgency to beat Atletico at last, and they need to score, obviously, that away goal. And also, they have to be very aware of Atletico on set pieces, because that's one of the major threats of Simeone's side.
If you were to look at it, is there more pressure on Atletico to maintain the run they've been on, or is the pressure greater on Real to end it and obviously to try and defend their Champions League title?
I think the pressure is always bigger on Real Madrid because the expectations are very high. The fans, they want them to win La Liga, which is something they have to do because there is still 2 points difference from Real Madrid to Barcelona, who are on the top of the table, but they got closer last weekend. And there is always the pressure of delivering on the Champions League. Last season, they won the decima, the 10th title. That was something they have been waiting for a long time, but still they want them to win the undecima, the 11th title, because they have no patience. This is the most demanding fans of the world. So the pressure is a very big test for Ancelotti, because he needs to prove that he can beat Atletico. They got the defeat against Barcelona in the Clásico, but I think Atletico are the hardest rivals they have so far this season, or in the last couple of seasons, and he's got to prove they can beat them.
It's remarkable when you look at all that Real Madrid have done in the most recent years, the level of scrutiny on the manager and the level of scrutiny on players in particular. It seems whatever they do, the fans simply want more and more.
And the fans can boo the manager, and they can boo the players, and they can even boo Cristiano Ronaldo, which is quite impressive. But that's the way the fans of Real Madrid behave. They are quite demanding, as I said. With Gareth Bale, I think the scrutiny has been very unfair. If you look at the numbers of Gareth Bale are not so bad. He in terms of goals and assists, I mean, he scored even key goals in that Champions League final in Lisbon against Atletico, a very key goal on the extra time, and also in the final of the Copa del Rey last season, the Spanish Cup. So what do you expect? This is Gareth Bale. This is the player we knew from Spurs, you know, long runs, quick runs, shots on target. He's not kind of the team player, but people are asking him to be more focused on defensive duties as well. But it's something Cristiano and Benzema should do as well. If you look at the strikers of Atletico, it's quite interesting. Griezmann and Mandzukic, they can be a centre back at some point when the other side is attacking, because they are very focused on defensive duties. And that's what Ancelotti is asking his strikers to do tonight, to be also focused on those defensive duties.
And to speak of Atletico, I was reading, obviously we have the return of Fernando Torres to the club this season. I was reading an article about his career and how he left Atletico because it was not a club that could compete in Spain or a club that could compete in Europe. He's now at that stage, and all of that is down to the work of Diego Simeone. And in your view, have Atletico reached their full potential yet, or is there much more to come under Simeone's management?
I think for Simeone, there is the ambition is still there, and there was a new investment, a Chinese entrepreneur now, which makes the ambition bigger as well for the Atletico, because in terms of budget, there was the issue of not being able to compete with the big teams in Real Madrid and Barcelona. It's not like the Premier League, the distribution of the TV rights is not equal. It's something that is being sorted in the Spanish football at the moment. But anyway, Simeone believes there is more to do. He wants the team to do ambition signings in the summer, difficult to reach the level of Atletico, of Real Madrid and Barcelona, but still, if he renewed his contract this season, it's because he genuinely believes they can go farther. And he wants to win the Champions League. Don't underestimate his ambition. Don't think that for them there's nothing to lose. Yes, if they are knocked out by Real Madrid, it's not a big drama, probably, but they want to go to the final because they want to beat the final, because they couldn't make it last season.
And that contract that Simeone signed, while he might have that ambition, a lot of people looked upon it as an opportunity for the club to increase his value should an English club come knocking, particularly an English club. But in your opinion, he is there for years to come, and he has not finished his project at Atletico.
Yes, I mean, he's an Atletico man deep inside. He was a player there. He won a title with, at the time, was Aragonés, was there. I mean, he that's his dream job, basically. Mm. He wanted to be the manager of Atletico de Madrid. And some people at the club believe that he could be the Alex Ferguson of Atletico de Madrid, but obviously the team has to deliver. The signings have to be ambitious. And he feels that there is that commitment from the club, but obviously there was a chance to go abroad and to get a more ambitious project, and probably the things at Real Atletico are not as well as they are at the moment. Probably he might think about the future, but at the moment he's very committed to Atletico.
To get your opinion on the outcome then from tonight, I think one thing that we can be certain of is that it will be quite a heated affair based on previous encounters. Do you fancy Atletico or Real Madrid to get the result?
It's difficult to predict with those sides. I mean, we were saying that it was going to be a very tight game, but the last time we said that, Atletico beat Real Madrid in February for 4-0. So I can see a very tight game, probably because there is this sense of urgency from Real Madrid to beat Atletico at last. I could see Real Madrid is slightly favourite, but difficult to predict, to be honest.
And just to get one word on tomorrow night's game, PSG against Barcelona, does the Madrid derby completely eclipse in the minds of most Spaniards the fact that you've got two of the biggest clubs in the world in PSG and Barca meeting tomorrow night?
Probably yes, but the Barca fans would say no. We are expecting Barcelona to beat PSG. They deeply believe Barcelona are favourites. They are on a good run at the moment, although they got this draw against Sevilla last weekend, but we all expected Sevilla to be a very strong side. They are fighting for the third position of the table. So I think Barcelona are in a very good form. They have those, you know, three strikers who are on top form at the moment, who are Neymar, Suarez and Messi, obviously. I think they are pretty much favourites, and when the draw happened, I think the fans were pleased because they know how to play against PSG. They previously played against them as well.
Begonia, enjoy the games. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Begonia Perez joining us there. Let's chat more European football as we do on Tuesday evenings on the programme with Mark Langdon of the Racing Post. Mark, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. And yourself?
Not too bad at all. I'm looking forward to the Madrid derby tonight and then the minor matter of PSG against Barca tomorrow night. Doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, it really doesn't. I would have liked to have seen, I'm always a bit sceptical of these sort of, you know, the national derby games in European competitions. I always like to see sort of, you know, teams from different leagues meeting, and I can expect quite a nasty game tonight between Atletico and Real Madrid. You know, a lot of bookings. Going to be difficult, I think, for the referee and, you know, to keep 22 players on the pitch just because of the pace that Atletico, will play it at to try to ruffle the feathers of Real Madrid. And I think it's going to be a very tasty affair. Not many goals and plenty of bookings in the process.
I think didn't last year's final set a record for the most yellow cards in a Champions League encounter ever? I think I had a brief look at it earlier on. I think it was 12 or 13 yellow cards, and all but two of the Atletico team, I think, were booked in the final.
Yeah, that they were taking it in turns, basically, to pick up a yellow card towards the end of the game. I mean, I suppose you have to put that into some sort of context in that, you know, Atletico got the lead early on and they was kind of, you know, just trying to protect it in that second half. They were getting tired and that they were just basically fouling whichever Real Madrid player had the ball, to break up play, which is understandable, I suppose, you know, that they were minutes away from becoming champions of Europe as well as becoming champions of Spain. So it was the biggest match, you know, arguably in their history. So I think that they were even more dirty than you normally imagine. But Diego Simeone teams always play on the edge of the law, that there's no doubt about that. Because they haven't got the superstars, they have to do things in a different way.
Then, briefly to get your view, Atletico or Real to do the business tonight?
I fancy Atletico to win at the Vicente Calderon. They've only lost two of their last 23 European matches, haven't conceded a goal at home in Europe this season, got a great record against Real Madrid. I think that Atletico will win the first leg. Whether it's enough or not, I'm not so sure.
Juve against Monaco. There is not a team in any competition would want to have to go to Turin with the home form that they've had and try to do anything.
No. Juventus are brilliant at home. I think that they would have been doing cartwheels at the draw. You know, obviously they won't be saying that in public, but you know, to get Monaco at the last eight stages is absolutely brilliant. For them, Pirlo's back in the starting 11 as well. First game back since he injured himself against Borussia Dortmund, and you know, Carlos Tevez is playing brilliantly up front. Morata's scoring goals as well. They're an excellent team, and I think that Monaco probably beat Arsenal down to Arsenal's complacency in that first leg, and it's very difficult to cause that kind of surprise two matches running, if you like. You know, Juventus will be wary of the counter-attacking threat. No Berbatov for Monaco tonight. Got a bit more pace up front. They're looking to sort of break quickly, but I think Juve will be too strong.
Just to put it in context, what Monaco have done this year, they reached the quarterfinals for the first time since 2004 when they went on to be runners-up. I think they've set a record for a team that was seeded fourth for the group stages to get to this point, or certainly equal the record, and they've set a record for the lowest ranked team to get to the quarterfinals. So it's been a season to remember in European football for them.
Yeah, it has. I suppose the reason they've got a low ranking really is because they've been in the second division for some time, and they got that quick influx of money, which you know, I know they've since lost Falcao and James Rodriguez, but still, that they've got a lot of good players. You know, Toulalong, Moutinho, Carrasco on the wings, a very good player at the back. Loads of experience, the likes of, you know, Ricardo Carvalho, and you know, so they're a good team. Although I think they just lack that star quality. I think they're a similar side really to the Malaga team that reached the quarterfinals, you know, and just went out to Borussia Dortmund. They're very defensive minded, very solid, but I mean, once they come up against a quality opponent, that should be the end of them.
Tomorrow night's games, Porto against Bayern Munich, the smart money, or all signs of form in European competition, would go on Munich to advance. Would you fancy them to win the first leg in Portugal?
Well, I would say they've got a lot of injuries, and I wouldn't be surprised if Pep Guardiola settled. Well, he wouldn't settle for a draw, because he never does, but I don't think he'd be too disappointed at a draw, given that, you know, Robben's out, Ribery's out, Schweinsteiger's out, Benatia is missing, Alaba is missing. They're all first teamers, and make no mistake about that, they only had four players on the bench when they beat Eintracht Frankfurt at the weekend, so their squad isn't the deepest, despite it being full of quality. So they've struggled in recent weeks, only just got past Leverkusen in the German Cup on penalties. So they're not at their best at the moment. They have a lot of possession, but without that penetration of Robben and Ribery on the flanks, it's difficult for them to sort of break teams down. And if Porto play to their absolute best, then they've got a small chance. But it looks like Jackson Martinez, their star striker, is also injured, which would sort of nullify their goal threat. So I think Bayern Munich will eventually progress, although it may be a bit of a grind in that first leg.
Then to finish and round it off, our feature game on RT2 television tomorrow night will be PSG against FC Barcelona. The great pity in all this is that the Zlatan derby is devoid of Zlatan.
Yeah, although PSG, I think, have got a good chance, even without Ibrahimovic and even without Verratti as well. You know, unbeaten, I think it's in 32 home matches in European competition. They've played Barca twice at home. They've beaten them once and drawn with them once. And, you know, even with, like I say, even without Ibrahimovic, you've got Cavani, who will probably enjoy not having Ibrahimovic up front alongside him, you know, so he can play in his more natural position as the centre forward. You've got plenty of pace on the wings in the likes of Lucas Moura and Lovetzi, and quality in Pastore in midfield. You know, Matuidi's an excellent player, and when you can bring in the likes of Kabay as sort of, you know, off the bench, you really have got a deep squad. There's no David Luiz, but I don't think that's a too much of a problem either, really, when you can replace him with Marquinhos. So, you know, I don't like Barcelona in these big away games, because I think they concede too many goals, and they rely so heavily on that front three to get them out of trouble. They scored twice against Sevilla at the weekend, and it still wasn't enough to win the game. And I think Paris Saint-Germain, again, I'm not sure they'll go through, but I think they can give a really good account of themselves tomorrow in that opening leg.
Brilliant. We'll chat about that much more tomorrow night in the programme. Mark, good to talk to you as always. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
Mark Langdon of The Racing Post. We're going to chat golf and much more after the break.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Gary Murphy, how are you, sir?
Very well, David.
You've returned from what a lot of people will have on their bucket list. You weren't with us last week because you were in the minor matter of Augusta National.
Yeah, it was an amazing trip. It looks phenomenal on TV, the golf course, but when you see it in the flesh, it's so much better. I was fortunate to be in university there for a couple of years back in the 90s. And it was just great coming back, and had a fantastic week.
Is it still as magic? Like, you know, I talked to Greg about this briefly on Friday, that it has got more commercial in terms of, like, Augusta National is now on computer games, and they've extended the level of TV coverage, and they've opened the doors somewhat to the big bad world that's out there. But is it still as special a place now as it would have been back in 94 when you were ploughing your life through college?
Yeah, I think the fact that I'm a little bit older, I've appreciated it. That bit more.
It's the jet lag.
It is the jet lag, unfortunately. But no, just the whole place. I mean, the grounds are enormous. You have no idea how. It's hard to get a feel for how big the grounds actually are. And no matter how far away from the beaten track you go, everything is still pristine. Mm. The practice facilities were. I mean, I spent, you know, quite a bit of time just watching guys, seeing how it's supposed to be done, and the practice facility is. It's incredible. And then you get out on the golf course and the patrons and everything else, and it's just a different tournament.
And that, you know, it is the golden ticket, and it's so hard to get to the Masters, and you'd want to sell your granny or hope that she was married to somebody with a green jacket. Does that make it a far more knowledgeable crowd? Does it make it a completely different experience, say, than going to the Irish Open or going to, you know, the Open Championship?
Well, I'd say, you know, British and Irish crowds aside, they're, you know, the spectators are very knowledgeable there. We're fortunate here when you're playing an Irish Open, and, you know, people can appreciate what a good shot is. And it's the same there. I mean, it's funny, like, the gates open and it's just a stampede in, and it's a religion because you have to set out your chair. Mm. It's a bit like the Germans with the towels on the beach. We're down by the pool. And they're really, you know, it actually fascinates me how keen, because you don't, if you sit there at the back of the range, you get to see exactly what you want to see. So from my point of view, that's my favourite place to try, watch and learn. Because, you know, the crowds, even though they're restricted, it's still pretty, I would say, 5-6 deep at least. So it's tough at times to see the action, and it's an incredibly hilly golf course. You can never get a feel for how hilly it is on TV. And it's quite a hike around there.
Well, I was going to say, who'd want to be a caddy, or who'd want to be a golfer having to trek over the course of you know, 5 or 6 days between practice and everything else? Just in terms of the performances, and everything that can possibly have been said about Jordan Spieth has been said over the weekend, because he ran away with it, and we ended up effectively in that strange position, even on Friday, where we were nearly analysing the end of the tournament, such was his early dominance, which he is a name that's been on the radar, but yeah, it blew everyone away.
I mean, as Colin will attest to as well, I mean, he, you know, Friday night means nothing at any golf tournament, never mind a major championship. His start was phenomenal. It was his first round was what won the golf tournament for him. He's an outstanding, I think, human being, which is a rarity in modern day sport, on top of being an outstanding golfer. Mm. And he's a 21-year-old with the probably at least a 35-year-old head on his shoulders.
And the lesson to be learned in all this is that, you know, people joke about having kids and sticking them straight into the range, or sticking them straight into practice. He seems to be a guy who just fell in love with the game and just played the game loose, that there was no sense of, you know, hours and days of repetition that we hear other golfers going through. It was just, I love this, let's give it a lash.
And he does it with a smile on his face, because his swing is by no means perfect. He does, you know, which is great for me, because there's so much information out there nowadays, and coaches and stuff are trying to build perfect golf swings, and it just doesn't exist. I mean, the whole thing is about your ball flight. If you can control that, it doesn't matter how you actually get to do it. And he's just a breath of fresh air, but he plays, you know, Rory had a big lead there and threw it away, and Spieth had the same thing and didn't, and McIlroy is still outstanding, still the best player in the world, but we finally have someone who's hot on his heels, because the media were trying to hype Ricky Fowler last year, and he's not the real deal, but Jordan Spieth is.
Okay, on and off the course. We're hoping to chat in a couple of minutes to Colin Byrne, who caddied for Ernie Els over the course of the weekend, but I think they're in action again this week, and the phones might be letting us down. He walked the course, you observed quite a lot of it. One of the questions being asked is that, despite the glamour of the Masters, did it need a phenomenal tournament in terms of a star performance or very low scores to reignite the world's love with it? Was Augusta National set up in such a way that it was there to be attacked to the level that Spieth did?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, if you look at, I mean, his score is, you know, off the charts. It's a record. It's the lowest score ever, tied with Tiger 97. And then you take 14 under in the second place, which is a great total on a tough golf course.
And the point has been made that, you know, the cliche that's been thrown out is that 14 under would have won 70 of the last 78, but they wouldn't have shot 14 under had Spieth not come out of the traps the way he did, because he gave them something to chase. You know where I'm coming from.
Yeah. I would say yes and no. I mean, Rory had a huge last 45. Matsuyama, my love child, had a huge.
I was actually going to text you because as I watched that rolling news channel on Monday morning, his name was prominent, and you've told me time and time again.
Well, I tipped up Spieth. He won it.
Eamon Dunphy tipped the first three.
I tipped up, yeah, but he's footballer. I mean, what would he know about golf?
Come here now. That's just pure luck, isn't it? That's serious golf tipping now. He had one,
tipped
two, three.
Tipped up Spieth, tipped up Rory, who was fourth, so he'd have paid you. And I tipped up Paul Casey, who's tied sixth.
Come here.
Henrik Stenson had the flu, couldn't do anything for that. And Jimmy Walker just let me down. I'll never speak to him again.
Okay. Overall, the Irish challenge. Like, Padraig Harrington went into it with great optimism and momentum. Graham McDowell, we've talked about in previous years, is it necessarily a track that suits Graham McDowell? Darren Clark's focus could be somewhere else. Shane and Rory, are they the ones that we really should be analysing? Because Rory, we expect a challenge, and Shane, we've got such high hopes of.
Yeah, I think Shane did well. I mean, it's he's unlucky to miss the cut. And when he came in, he held a really good putt. I followed him in the last few holes. He held a couple of, he held a great putt in 17 for birdie. And tricky little 6-footer down a hill on the last, which we were hoping was good enough to make the cut. So it's, you know, hugely disappointing for him. He's not playing golf tournaments to make cuts. But he will have learnt a lot. And he looks very comfortable in that environment, and that's all he can ask for. Rory is, he's still the best player in the world. He, on the practice ground, I know it's not played there, but he's still a long way ahead of the other guys. But Spieth looks extremely exciting, and he's playing again this week too,
which is does that surprise you that you come straight back out, or would you have your head in the sand and celebrate for a couple of weeks, just let it all sink in?
The only thing is that he's played three weeks in a row, three hard weeks where he's been in contention, so he's undoubtedly tired. He's in New York yesterday doing, you know, kind of promo stuff,
the Today Show and all that sort of stuff, Letterman.
He's very switched on. He knows exactly what he wants.
Couple of texts into 51552, or you can tweet at GameOn2FM. Point being made, Rory's best Masters, so while we have the expectation on him, he's heading in the right direction when it comes to Augusta National.
Oh, totally. I mean, as I said last week, I was a little bit worried that, you know, if he didn't get off to a good start, it might affect his chances of winning, which he didn't. The reality is he can't win them all. And no one will ever win them all, so fourth is very good. People have to understand golf's an exceptionally difficult sport. And for him to start as poorly as he did by his standards and come back and play the last 45 holes the way he did shows a huge level of maturity.
Again, El Tigre, does Gary think Tiger Woods is a faded star? Should he give up?
I watched Tiger on the range on Sunday morning, and it was absolutely mind-boggling how the simple mistake that he's making, and his coach, Chris Como, stood behind him. He's standing up aiming to hit a fade, and he's trying to hit draws. So those double crosses and those snaps that he gets. So basically, ideally, if you're trying to hit a ball left to right, you swing down your shoulder line and you let the face do the work, and the ball starts left and comes back right. He's aiming with his shoulders open. If you're trying to draw the ball, you have to have your shoulders a little bit close to the target. His are open, and he's trying to hit a draw. And that's a simple basic in golf. Everyone gets ramped up in different things and makes things very complicated. But if your basics are off, you've got no chance. And his coach stood behind him for 40 minutes and couldn't spot that. I was blown away by it.
But How is that possible at this level of sport, where every single thing that a guy does is analysed within, in golf's case, a centimetre of its life? Like, is that a case that he's too big to be coached? He's too big to be told you're doing this wrong, or is it just simply inadequate?
Well, that's the coach's problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Like, I'm not saying if you can spot that, how can a coach not spot it? But how can Tiger Woods not, the guy who's the man who's defined the sport, not see a simplistic mistake like that?
Because I guess in rallying, you know, every rally driver needs a good co-driver. You know, you can't see everything. I mean, that's why you need help. because you can't do it all yourself. But the thing that I found baffling was there were celebrity coaches there with their players, last round, ready to go. And Jordan Spieth there, 21 years of age, just him and his caddy. I'm here, I'm ready to go, let's play.
And the caddy is a phenomenal story. A guy who I think was a maths teacher, met him when he was 18 or 19, and basically gave up everything to go be Jordan, to try and get Jordan Spieth on the road.
He'll need to be a maths teacher to work out his wages this year, the way things are going. You know, and Spieth's big news, and it's... I was blown away with Tiger, though, how he could... You know, he looks good. He certainly looks close, but there's no fear. Like, there was a funny thing on Saturday on the range. He was hitting shots and Kevin Na came over to say something to him jokingly. Now, had that been 10 years ago, there is no way in the world that would have happened.
There was
not a hope in hell. He'd been afraid of his life to go over to him.
I saw the point being made. I think it was at the final round where he was walking out and not a single person put their hand out for a high five, which people, I can't remember who, it was some golf journalist. It was one of the guys from the, I think it would have been Jason Sobel, was basically saying that shows you where Tiger is at. Then, you know,
you're probably not allowed high five.
There was everyone else getting high fives. Delighted to say we've established phone connection with North Carolina. Colin Byrne joins us. Colin, how are you?
Hi, sorry about that.
Not at all.
Difficulties here in America.
The curse of modern technology. We've been chatting quite a bit about Jordan Spieth, and one of the big questions coming in is if this guy is just simply the superstar that everyone thinks he will be. What do you reckon, having seen him at close quarters over the last couple of months?
Yeah, well, we actually played with him in Houston a couple of weeks ago in the first two rounds. You know, and probably what's impressive is that he's not really that impressive tee to green. Now, you know, I don't say that lightly. He's just like most other golfers. He does everything pretty well tee to green. But when he gets on the green, he's the most impressive putter I think I've ever seen. He is remarkable. I think even if he misses, his ball looks like it's trying to find the hole somehow, and it just barely misses. So he really is an exceptional putter, and that's obviously why you look at his putting stats. That's why he does what he does.
Overall, your impression from the weekend, like he simply just blew everyone away, which means he's dominating it. But what else stood out for you, or who else are the performers we should stand up and recognise, or that you guys would have been talking about in the caddies room?
Well, I mean, I think firstly, if I just make a point about the golf courts, you know, I think the Green Jackets decided that they wanted some noise in the Amen Corner, noise in the back nine, with birdies and eagles, and obviously on Saturday, Dustin Johnson provided all that entertainment with three eagles. You know, because the course was quite soft. That probably was a decision by the Green Jackets, but also with the wind. It was a southwest wind, which normally is a bit of a northerly wind this time of year in Augusta, which really dries out the green and makes them, you know, that's the only thing that combats these great players, is firm greens. But the greens were receptive every day, and obviously, you know, the scores reflected that. But, you know, it kind of backfired on them as well, because, you know, they were so receptive that Jordan got so far ahead. Again, the whole excitement seemed to be a bit calmer than it should have been. But, you know, I think it was a conscious effort to get the cheers going around the back nine again. You heard them, you know, there was resounding around the golf course. And in terms of other people, I mean, obviously Rory's performance was fantastic. Justin Rose, you know, obviously Tiger, that people thought it was probably amazed that he made the cut, and he challenged to a degree. But there's no doubt that Jordan is the man to beat at the moment. I know it's going to be a tough week this week, but you know, he is the man on fire.
Okay, Colin, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks indeed for your time. Good to talk to you again. Colin Byrne, caddy, joining us there, who caddied for Ernie Els, who incidentally is coming to the Irish Open alongside Sergio Garcia, Lee Westwood. Like, Rory has put his contacts book where his name is.
Yeah, he's done great. I wouldn't say he's reignited it from nothing, because it's always been a great championship, but he's certainly playing his part as world number one, and he's giving a lot of his time, because if these guys are coming over to play, he's going to have to return the favour, and fair play to him.
Fair play to him. I've got one bit of business to attend to before I relive a sad moment for the Liverpool fans such as you. This weekend, 2FM is the home of yet another 10k giveaway, which means one text could mean €10,000 to one of you by the end of this week. 2FM is raiding the piggy bank here to give away 10k to one of our listeners by this Friday evening. That's 10k in cash, no strings attached, no physical or embarrassing challenges, just a whole lot of cash for you to spend as you please. So to get your entry in early for the ultimate prize, keep your your phone by your side, incidentally, because we will stop the clock from time to time to give away a cheeky check to keep you in the money. So to begin with, your chance to win and get your hands on €10,000, correctly answer this question. Would you know this now? Zayn Malik recently left which of these bands? One Direction or Boyzone? You would know the answer.
I do.
Yeah. To begin with your chance to win €10,000, text the word cash followed by your answer and name to 57111. Each entry costs €1 or £1. You must be over 18 to enter. Full details, terms and conditions are available on our website. Lines will close at 6:45 on Friday. Colin will call the winner live during drive-by on Friday before 7 o'clock. So you must be available to take the call if you want to win the cash. Do you remember what happened this day in 2009?
I do.
What is it?
Liverpool and
Chelsea.
That other mob.
One of the great knockout ties in Champions League football. We're going to relive it now. Liverpool and Chelsea, as was really the norm, because they got drawn together at so many stages in the Champions League back in those days. We're drawn to meet in the quarterfinals of the 2008-2009 Champions League. First leg at Anfield saw Liverpool beaten 3-1, and in effect, they looked dead and buried. All of that before a remarkable second leg at Stamford Bridge.
Check crouches, ready to pounce. Great delivery from Aurelio last time. 4-1 this. Oh, it's there! It's not a poor delivery at all. It's a super goal. It deceived everybody. And Liverpool are in front. Got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be. And as ever from this position, it's Fabio Aurelio. Hoisted this time. Offside. Look, the whistle's gone, not for offside. It's a penalty. Ivanovic, was it? It is. Arms all around Alonso. Alonso, whose goal ended Chelsea's long unbeaten run at Stamford Bridge, has put Liverpool level on aggregate. And all Chelsea have now are the away goals. Tonight's the night. Let's live it up. There's Lampard. Anelka. Cross in. Drogba. The near post. Oh, Real's put it in. Chelsea are back in business. A gift from the Liverpool goalkeeper. Time for cool heads for Liverpool. It's Alex to thump it. Oh, what a goal! What a goal! There's a very different complexion on it now. Malak for Drogba with some space. Drogba, pass Skirtle, Drogba, Lampard! That's that! We'll shut it down! Chelsea in command now, but Liverpool lead 3. Then Ayew, Lukash, deflection, takes it home! Liverpool have got one of the three. But Liverpool have now got it back to 3-3 on the night, 6-4 on aggregate. And if it were to end up with two more goals for Liverpool, well, they'd be home and hosed on the away goals. It's Riera. It's Coutts! It's unbelievable! Dear Coutts puts Liverpool back in front. There are 8 minutes to go, and Liverpool, if they score again, will have themselves into the semi-final. We're inside the final 2 minutes. Drogba wins it back. Now it's Anelka. Anelka for Lampard! This sensational contest has finally and conclusively swung Chelsea's way. The sensational evening of European football at Stamford Bridge ends in victory for Chelsea. 4-4 on the night. 7-5 on aggregate.
Game on 2FM.
In association with Rabo Direct, the straight-talking savings bank.